New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Margaret Renkel, and she is the author of many books, including The Comfort of Crows. I'd love to talk about, there is something that you mention in your book about going back 40 years later to your college and looking at the growth of the trees and the bushes and everything and the birds and the flowers and all of the life, that the natural life there on the campus. And I call that there is something that we have, what we call the shifting baseline. And each generation has this baseline of what they know to be the natural world. But that shifts. I mean, the baseline that you had 40 years ago is very different from the generations of college students today. So can you say something about how that was for you to walk on the campus and what you felt to see how it changed?
I just remember in that essay, you're talking about this professor who had come to Auburn from Michigan. And he was just telling our class, I'm sure it had nothing to do with what we were studying. I think he was just probably passing time before class really started. But he was saying that he had had no choice but to install air conditioning in his house, though he had never had air conditioning before, because he could handle the heat, but the bird song was so loud outside his study, he couldn't think because of the birds singing, and he needed to be able to close the window. And I remember when I was visiting in 2019, so many of the trees are gone because they've extended the campus. They've built new buildings, and they've torn down old buildings and put up new buildings in their place, and that always causes the loss of trees. There just really wasn't that same cacophony of birdsong that my professor was describing in his study and outside his study. And so it made me think about just what you describe. It made me think about how the college students wandering that campus right then were probably thinking that they were hearing a lot of birds. And only somebody who knew what it had sounded like 40 years earlier would realize that that was not so many birds, really. And of course, 40 years ago, there were far fewer than there had been 40 years before that.
Right.
And this is one of the things that makes it so hard for people to understand the crisis we're really facing at a visceral level, because you have to have a certain amount of age to have observed these things happening with your own eyes. And it's hard to take it in as an abstraction. It's really much easier to take it in when you can think about, when's the last time I saw a turtle in my yard? When's the last time I saw lightning bugs? When's the last time I saw a butterfly? And then it's only when you start to ask those questions that you then begin to wonder, what's happened?
What's happened, exactly. In your writings, what's so wonderful about them is that you constantly take us back to, okay, all of that is going on. It is going on. We see it. We feel it. But you say, okay, we can write checks to the National Wildlife Foundation or whatever it is, or we sign a petition. But you say, go out and make a garden and even make an untidy garden. I love it. And you remind us, okay, we hold all of that, but we can also do something else that nurtures our soul and also nurtures the natural world. So say something about your untidy garden.
One thing I think that happens, well, first of all, it helps to know that an untidy garden is more helpful to the natural world than a hyper-tidy one is. So in nature, plants are tangled together. They create a dense overstory at the garden level that protects the roots of the plant from excessive sun. It holds moisture in, and it gives little creatures a place to hide. I was watching a very young rabbit yesterday morning early, just trying out the hopping apparatus, and it kept leaping into the air and twisting around and then running around my pollinator garden and then dashing through it from one side to the other. And when it finally decided it was time to go to bed for the day, it found a little patch of Solomon seal to tuck itself into, you know, that's very protected and shaded and invisible. There was, unless you had been standing in my front window watching it, you would never know there was a little bunny in there. And I think that knowing that the garden benefits from profusion and entanglement and wildness is the best possible combination, because you think, okay, it's not just easier, it's better. And you can hardly ever go wrong with something that is both easier and better.
There you go. There you go. Easier and better. And I know that you have planted many, many trees in your yard, and you have watched in your neighborhood the tearing down of some of the older homes and things, I call them McMansions, are being erected. There's a phrase that the developers might do. They might say, the roots were of these old trees are inconvenient. That's the phrase you use. Roots are inconvenient. It blew my circuits. I've had recently in the last few weeks in my life, right here, right outside my window, And I feel bereft that I did not figure out the name of the tree. I do know the tree, and it was huge. It was like maybe 14 inches across its trunk. It's been there a long time. And the corporation that owns the place, the apartments where I live, felt like the roots were inconvenient.
That's right.
And because it was kind of going something to do with the sewage system and the pipes. And rather than spend extra money to figure that out, they cut all these seven of these old trees down. And I watched it happen in a day, and it just broke my heart. I wrote a piece about it because it just broke my heart to see that. And you plant lots of trees. And I know you've had your neighbor say, I don't want your leaves in my yard, so you shouldn't have so many trees. They have too many leaves. So what's your response to neighbors who are saying, you have too many trees?
Well, that neighbor is gone.
Oh, thank goodness.
But my neighbors are wonderful. A few years ago, we live on a corner lot, and I put up a sign on one side, on one street, and a sign on the other street. On one street, the sign is from the Xerxes Society for the Protection of Invertebrates, and it's a certified pollinator habitat sign. It says that my garden is a certified pollinator habitat. And on the other street, there's a sign that says, that sign is from the Tennessee Wildlife Federation, and it says that our yard is a certified wildlife habitat. And I think when people understand that there's a reason for what you're doing, The Xerces Society sign even has a QR code you can point your phone at, and it will take you to some information about what a pollinator habitat is, what pollinators need you not to do. And it's in, and I think that creating a condition where my yard does look messy, it's a very scruffy yard, and the yards that surround us are pristine. But I think my neighbors understand why, because of those signs and because they know me. And my hope is that someday it will, they might decide that to join, you know, to combine their property with, to create a corridor even that is, you know, there's only so much a person with half an acre can do. And if my neighbor with the half acre lot on one side and my neighbor with the half acre lot on the other side and my later neighbor with the half acre lot across the street, if they all, they don't have to do exactly what we've done, but if they held off on the pesticides and if they planted some trees and some native plants that would feed our wild neighbors, there would be instantly a profusion of life, an explosion of life, because nature is just waiting to bounce back.
Yes. 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 It's so resilient. It really is, if we give it half a chance. And we've done programs about the pesticides and what they've done to the whole food chain and everything. It's really important. And I think it's coming up too. I think even there's some legislation now, there's some realization on a political level about pesticides and things and what they're doing, because there've been some fairly strong and big lawsuits that some of these companies are losing because people are saying, hey, you can't do this. So, but it's so much fun to have it like right there. And I'm thinking, Margaret, of your own life and the wildlife that you share outside. But let's go inside for a moment. The companion on your desktop. I don't know if you still have this companion. I mean, you've written this book and it's been several years probably, that you have this neighbor that you share your life with at your desk.
Well, I think you're talking about the spider.
I am talking about
that
the spider.
That spider is gone. That particular species of spider doesn't live for very long. But yeah, the spider's children, they are everywhere.
Okay, let's talk about that a little more thoroughly in just one moment. I just want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Margaret Rinkle, and she is the author of The Comfort of Crows, A Backyard Year, and also the author of Late Migrations, A Natural History of Love and Loss, and the other book, Graceland at Last, Notes on Hope and Heartache from the American South. If you want to know more about her website, go to margaretrinkle.com, and she spells her last name R-E-N-K-L, margaretrinkle.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
Thank you.
I'm here with Margaret Renkel, and we're talking about the natural world, untidy gardens, and sharing our life with wildlife, even at our desktop. And we were just starting to talk about a spider that you shared your desktop with. Tell us, how was that? A lot of people would say, oh, I got to crush a spider. I got to get rid of a spider. But you had a different response.
Well, I think people do have that reaction to spiders. There are certain things in the natural world that you have a harder time persuading people to love. Almost everybody can be persuaded to love a blue jay. Not so much a rat snake or a house spider, but they all have a place. And in this particular summer, that when I wrote that essay, there we were keeping a worm composter only a few feet away next to my writing table, and the compost materials were attracting fruit flies that were coming in through cracks in the window and when the door was open. And so I would take one of the bananas or apple or something, apple core, that was attracting the fruit flies, and I would put it in this outdoors in this contraption, this special kind of hummingbird feeder. Because hummingbirds, many people don't know this, but hummingbirds do require protein to feed their babies. They're feeding on nectar primarily as adults, but they need to feed their babies protein. And the fruit flies are the perfect size for a hummingbird baby. So I would open the worm composter, and this cloud of fruit flies would erupt out of there when I was taking out a piece of fruit to put in the hummingbird feeder. But I didn't have to worry about the fruit flies because the spider took care of them. There she was, just with her web stretched between an African violet and a Mother's Day orchid, and right there where I could look at her. And we just had a very companionable summer together while she was feeding the hummingbirds, taking care of the fruit flies that didn't make it outside to feed the hummingbirds.
I love it. And it's just a cycle of life right there in front of you. Yeah. And you also have a little piece in the book about a spider in the sink, I think. And there was a spider in my bathroom sink. I had turned on the water and then I noticed the spider and I quickly turned off the water so it wouldn't go down the drain. And what I noticed, Margaret, was it's an image that's so burned in my memory, is the spider got closer, almost went down the drain, and it lifted up, and I want to call it a paw, but it was a leg. It lifted up one of its leg to brace itself against the drain plunger. You know, I watched it. It wasn't a big spider. It was a smaller spider, and it just lifted its leg and braced itself against that drain plunger so it wouldn't go down the drain. And I realized there was some sort of consciousness in this little being, this live creature. And I was able to coax it away from the drain, and then eventually I was able to take it outside. And I was so happy. I was so happy that it survived and it didn't go down the drain. And I don't know. So there, that spider that you were with, I mean, just thinking about these tiny, tiny little beings that are part of the wildlife that we live amongst. It's right there.
I think that's one of the things I wrote this book for, is just in the hope that people would start to look around and recognize that all of these creatures they share the world with have a consciousness. And they all will squat down when they see us and hold still and hope that we go away. And when you start looking at the world that way, it's very hard to go back. And I want to be clear, I don't think that the natural world is endlessly resilient. We have lost and we are going to lose so many species, not just individual toads from our backyards, but whole species of amphibians we have lost and are going to lose. But if we are falling in love with our own companions, our own natural companions in our own ecosystems, whether that's an apartment in the city or a half-acre yard in the suburbs or a multi-acre farm, it doesn't matter. When we fall in love with them, we can't help but want to save them. And once that consciousness, once we hit that level, we start to understand that, then we are able to make active efforts to save them, not just to plant milkweed, not just to plant trees, but to write our senators, to write our congressmen, to exert pressure on the people who can change things at a macro level while we are still changing things at the micro level.
Yes, yes. Boy, I'm so with you with that. Absolutely. I'd love for you also as a writer. I mean, you write for the New York Times and you have a regular column there, and you're constantly writing like with the Humanities Tennessee. And so anyway, you do a lot of writing all the time, and I'd love for you to share anything that you can say about writing as an exercise of faith in you, and how you often take a wandering route with your writing. But share with us any ideas and advice about how you write that might inspire us.
For me, writing is it is a kind of active meditation, depending on what I'm writing. If I'm writing a political argument, not so much, but writing about the natural world, even at the very domestic level, or writing about my family, or writing about anything that's close to my heart that way, there's something about assigning words one after another. There's something about that is very calming. It takes something that feels chaotic and unruly in my own mind, and it imposes a kind of order. And in doing that, it slows me down and it calms me down, and I can look at it with greater clarity. The one trick I have that, you know, maybe might be of use to other writers is that I really believe that writing every day, not necessarily at great length, not necessarily for a long time, but writing every day, it helps so much, because it keeps those gears turning invisibly behind the scenes. So when I'm writing something and I don't quite know what the word is, or I don't know where to go next, or I can't figure out how to get from point A to point B. I know what point A and point B are, but I don't know what that bridge is between them. I go for a walk. I wash the dishes. I hang clothes on the line. And while my mind is nominally occupied with the task at hand, the other part of my mind is worrying. It's figuring this out without my direction. And I think that there's a big advantage to working a little bit at a time. And I wrote Late Migrations very largely in 15-minute increments, because that was the nature of my life at the time. That was all I could put together. I had a full-time editing job. I had a dying mother-in-law. I had three kids at home. Yeah. But what it meant was that when I sat back down for that 15 minutes the next day, I didn't have to reacquaint myself with my project. My brain, my mind had been working through it even while I had been busy doing something else.
Exactly. And that just reminds me, Margaret, that you have written about a little bit about the science of walking. Mm-hmm. That it does something to the brain. Do you recall that research?
Yes, it was a Stanford University research project where they had college students. They did a test that is widely recognized to measure creativity, a baseline test. And then they divided the students into three groups. They had one group of students go for a walk on a preordained trek on campus. They had one group of students walking on a treadmill. And they had another group of students who stayed at a desk, and then they readministered the creativity test. And they found that both the students who were walking on a treadmill and the students who were walking on campus measurably improved their creativity quotient after having walked.
Wow. Okay. We're all going to get out there and walk, right? Oh, Margaret, it's been such a pleasure being with you. Thank you so much for being on New Dimensions today. Thank you. I've been speaking with Margaret Ringel, and she's the author of The Comfort of Crows, A Backyard Year, as well as Late Migrations and also Graceland at Last. If you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, margaretrinkle.com, and she spells her last name, R-E-N-K-L, margaretrinkle.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3794.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You, too, can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the Donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org, or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support, and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Vasavi Kumar, author of Say It Out Loud. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about using the power of your voice to reframe negative self-talk.
You're listening to CJ.